a man who had once been their dearest friend. Okami's father had betrayed Ranmaru's father. This was the reason Okami served Ranmaru. The reason he held such unswerving allegiance to the Black Clan. These two boys were inextricably linked by this betrayal. Linked by life and death. A friendship forged in blood and fire. As Ranmaru's story faded like a ghost into the night, the image from several days past, the memory of the boy standing in a courtyard, staring at stones stained red with his father's blood, formed in Mariko's mind. As she'd first thought, this boy was Takeda Ranmaru. Not a boy anymore. Now a young man, imbued with a shadowed purpose. One Mariko had only begun to grasp. Against her will, her curiosity abated, like a tide pulling from a desolate shore. In its place rose a tentative sadness, a halting kind of sympathy. She could not imagine what it would be to lose her family right before her eyes, to lose all she held dear in an instant. Her mother, her father, Kenshin. But it could happen. This forest had taught her that, even in a few short days. As Mariko considered the possibility of such loss, a heaviness settled onto her skin. A burn began to rise in her throat, the burn of injustice. Ranmaru had killed her father's men, and Chiyo. He'd tried to kill Mariko, and she would never forget it. Follow orders. Engender trust. Strike when they least expect it. Watch closely, Sanada Takeo. Ranmaru slid his sword from the dead boy's slumped body and stood tall. This forest protects us. These trees, the Juboko, are everywhere. Our forest is guarded by yokai, and they will not look kindly on you should you attempt to run. Should you attempt to betray us in any way. He turned to face her. But if you stay true, one day Jukai Forest may serve you as well. Mariko stared down at the lifeless young man. His skin had taken on a waxy hue. To her left, Okami finally spoke, his words a whisper on a dying wind. Never forget, Sanada Takeo. In this forest, there is no place to hide. The Throwing Star. Over the course of the next 4 days, Mariko listened, followed orders without complaint. She learned that many of the 20 or so members of the Black Clan left the camp at odd hours, often returning laden with small trunks of silk, with leather satchels of gold ryo and countless tins of copper pieces. Then they would leave again under a cloak of darkness, taking their stolen spoils deep beneath the trees, disappearing from sight. In this forest, there is no place to hide. Okami's words echoed through Mariko's mind like a haunted refrain. They gave her leave to shudder when she thought no one was watching, to embrace her fears as she never had before. Mariko discovered there was wisdom in facing her fears headlong. Acknowledging them made her cautious, made her smarter. Perhaps these fears would help her obtain a shred of information, something to warrant all this effort. Anything to justify the horrors she had witnessed 4 nights ago in Jukai Forest. She needed a way to earn the Black Clan's trust. If not their trust, then at least a semblance of their admiration. With it, she could then begin digging her way to the truth, like an army of termites set to decimate a structure from within. If the incident with the Juboko had taught her anything, it was that one way to gain Ranmaru's confidence was through Okami. Their bond seemed unshakable. The kind of trust built over time. Alas, Mariko could not begin to understand how to earn the wolf's favor. He was not exactly the demonstrative sort. Now, she was left to fight for Ranmaru's attention on her own. So intent was she on devising the best way to impress the leader of the Black Clan that it had taken her 5 days to work up the courage to take action. And though she now possessed a plan, Mariko still remained uncertain. Whatever free time left to her had been spent mulling over the details, considering the possibilities, all while putting aside the likelihood that at any moment her great secret might be revealed. That a member of the Black Clan might learn she was not, in fact, a boy. Fear again took hold of Mariko, leaving her immobile for a breath, leaving her weakened. The only remedy was to return its cold embrace once more. It fed her, this fear. It gave her a sense of will. Mariko straightened her shoulders, reshaped her thoughts. Ranmaru had paid her no attention today. As far as he was concerned, Mariko could be a single leaf among many. Okami was equally hopeless. An endless well covered by years of neglect. Only two members of the Black Clan continued to pay Mariko mind. Ren and Yoshi. The former plagued her at every turn. The latter made it his duty to instruct her on the most inconsequential of lessons. How to light a fire, how to boil water, how to dig for edible roots. Ever since the night the Juboko had drained the young intruder of life, Mariko had been left to handle the most trivial tasks around the camp. Washing pots, plucking feathers, and of course, collecting firewood. This lack of attention only hardened her resolve, drove her toward a loftier goal. Now that she had successfully infiltrated the Black Clan's ranks, Mariko endeavored to gain access to its inner circle. Only by doing so would she ever obtain any information of import, and discover the truth of why they'd been sent to kill her. The most valuable knowledge she'd gleaned in the last few days was learning that Okami left camp alone every other morning, armed with nothing but a bow, and did not return until well after nightfall. Not that his absence mattered much to her. The wolf spent his time in camp hidden in his tent. But Mariko was not fool enough to think he wasted any effort. These repeated absences were definitely a matter of note. Where was he going? Was it possible he was meeting with those holding sway over the Black Clan? With those who wished her dead? As Mariko delved into the countless possibilities before her, she continued to fight with a bundle of dirty hemp cloth that had been left by her feet while she slept. Gritting her teeth, she wrangled the rough bolt of fabric straight, struggling to anchor a length of it onto a bamboo pole. Someone, likely Yoshi, had left her the means with which to build her own tent. Mariko had felt strangely elated to discover this gift. The tent proved that at least one member of the Black Clan found her useful, wished for her to stay. She was reminded of Ren's error in divulging Ranmaru's plans to make her their newest recruit. Perhaps this was a sign she had made progress to that end. Though Ren's nasty attitude indicated otherwise, it was obvious someone in the camp supported the notion. She'd even been given a place to call her own. Tonight would be the first night Mariko would not have to sleep on a pile of rocks and debris. If she could ever put together the cursed thing. Just before Mariko succumbed to the desire to fling the hemp fabric into the underbrush, a hand scored by numerous burns reached out, snatching the bundle from her grasp. Yoshi loomed above her, his red face mottled by irritation.
"Are you still trying to put that tent together?"
He sat on the ground, swinging his wooden limb into position before him. Mariko considered it for a spell. Many times in the last few days, she'd wanted to ask Yoshi how he'd lost his leg. But she was learning to expect two things from the surly cook. He did not reveal information without intention, and he did not permit anyone to make excuses for anything. "As you undoubtedly know by now, Yoshi-san, I have never been in possession of this skill, likely because I have never been granted the opportunity," she joked awkwardly. "But even so, I do feel as though I am missing something." Yoshi rummaged through the bamboo rods and the knotted ball of twine by their feet.
Who gave these to you?
His lower lip pouted in a frown.
I thought you did, she blinked. But if it was not you, then perhaps it was Ren.
His concern for my welfare has been nothing but consistent, Mariko said bitterly. The creases vanished from his blotchy brow as understanding settled on Yoshi.
You're missing two key pieces of framing.
Perhaps it was indeed Ren who had left her the tent. Only he would have enjoyed watching Mariko suffer through trying to accomplish such an impossible task.
That miserable little fiend.
Don't be angry with him.
Yoshi sent half a smile her way.
Ren has led quite a difficult life. He's less a fiend and more a wounded cat.
Mariko mumbled. Wounded cats still possess claws.
True,
he laughed.
I'll retrieve the missing pieces.
Yoshi peered at her through one narrowed eye.
Have you shared your idea with Haruki yet?
She shifted uncomfortably. No.
Then tell him about it while I piece together your tent.
He spoke as though there was not even a question of Mariko following his directive. A strange mix of comfort and concern rippled through her. Of course she disliked being told what to do, but she also appreciated someone, anyone, caring enough to try. Despite the murmurings of her mind, Mariko's heart would not permit her to dislike Yoshi.
Perhaps you shouldn't help me, she said. Someone might steal your tent frame as punishment.
Someone?
He barked a laugh.
I won't disclose who.
Mariko smiled in return.
But a certain someone might seek retribution for you showing me this kindness.
No one would dare, lest that certain someone find himself perishing of starvation. You idiot boys don't even know how to cook rice properly, much less anything of substance.
With this final pronouncement, Yoshi pushed her in the direction of the hillock to her left. Then he rolled the bundle of hemp cloth and took to his feet once more, intent on finding Ren and the missing lengths of bamboo. Distress flashed through Mariko. She briefly considered flouting Yoshi's orders, or perhaps even lying about it later. But the churlish cook would learn the truth, and he would not be pleased that she'd failed to meet with a metalsmith for yet another day. Not to mention the dishonor of unnecessary deceit. It wasn't that deception by its very nature troubled her. Mariko realized its necessity, especially when paired alongside survival. But bald-faced lies were not the same thing. So with a sigh, she began walking toward the small hill nearby, drawn to the feather of smoke rising from the fabric wall at its crest. One side of the hill was shaded by a looming stone protuberance, one of the many small outcroppings that eventually burgeoned into the snow-capped mountain in the distance. On her second day there, Mariko had realized how strategically positioned the camp of the Black Clan was. This collection of outcroppings offered them natural fortification, preventing anyone from attacking their flank. She dug her heels into the soft earth and pressed onward, her calves burning from the steep incline. As Mariko walked, her mind continued its unceasing mutterings. It was Yoshi who'd first pushed her to take her rendering of the throwing star to the Black Clan's metalsmith. He'd told her the idea had merit, and he'd not once called her foolish or found her efforts unwanted or out of place. It was a strange feeling, to have one of her enemies be the first among her acquaintances to appreciate her ideas. Mariko paused before the wall of smoke-stained fabric, taking in a breath, seeking courage of a lasting kind.
Hello?
She said in a brusque voice. When the metalsmith emerged from behind the fabric wall of his jinmaku, Mariko released a pent-up breath, allowing the relief to flood through her. Haruki, the metalsmith, was none other than the boy she'd noticed that first night at the watering hole. The one with the shining skin, who looked as though he'd been taken from a childhood story about a boy who floated through the sky, buoyed into the clouds by an oiled paper umbrella. Mariko recalled him watching the leaves sway through the maple trees with an almost otherworldly kind of serenity. At least this boy would not take it upon himself to torment her as Ren had. At least she hoped. Haruki was tall and lean, with a narrow face and wide-set eyes.
The front part of his hair was too short to fit into its topknot. The strands hung straight and loose. Only his hands and his hachimaki appeared marred by soot. He stood in silence as he studied her. Not a judgmental kind of silence, not even a silence laced by curiosity. He merely gave her leave to speak first.
Yoshi said,
"I was wondering when you would come here." Haruki smiled with his eyes, his voice pleasing and precise. "Yoshi told me about you last week." Startled, Mariko stood still.
"I didn't realize he'd said anything."
"One thing we all learn early on is to say very little to Yoshi. He likes his gossip almost more than he likes his food." He wiped both his hands on a cloth hanging from his dark leather belt. Then he mopped the sweat from his neck. When the collar of his kosore shifted, lines of scarred skin became visible, wrapping around his shoulder like a set of monstrous fingers. He was badly whipped in his past. Mariko caught her voice before it could speak out of turn and ask questions to which she did not need answers. "I should not care. I do not care."
"My name is Haruki."
He dipped his head in a small bow. Steeling herself, Mariko returned the gesture.
"Sanara Takeo."
"I know." She pursed her lips. Was it always necessary for boys to prove they knew more than anyone else around them?
"I suppose Yoshi also told you why I wanted to come here."
"He said you had something you wished to show me." It was a hedging kind of answer, one that made Mariko immediately wary.
"And you weren't curious?" she said.
"You do ask a lot of questions." Haruki smiled calmly. "And no, I wasn't curious. I expected you to come my way when you were ready." Again, he waited for her to speak. It was time for Mariko to stop being worried that everyone she met harbored hidden agendas, that Haruki the metalsmith would laugh at her or dismiss her. Yoshi had said her idea was a good one, and this was the only way to see if both he and she were right. Mariko lifted her gaze to meet Haruki's.
"I wanted to ask if you could make a kind of kunai for me."
"A throwing dagger?" He studied her once more, but she could not read his expression.
"For you?"
"Yes, ultimately."
"No, not for me."
She inhaled deep.
"I meant to say a kunai based on my design. One with many edges."
As she spoke, Mariko knelt before him and began sketching in the dirt with a small stick, almost in a circle. She drew what at first glance appeared to be a sun, with six rays curling away from it. "If you curve the blades in the same direction, it can be thrown in a rotating fashion, thereby allowing it to fly farther and faster."
Haruki crouched beside her, considered her design.
"This would be difficult to make," he pronounced after a time, "and the amount of steel necessary would be quite costly, especially for a weapon a warrior might discard. What if you used iron instead? It's softer and less expensive than steel." Haruki's eyes grazed over her drawing a second time, still considering.
"Even if it were made of iron, a weapon like this would take far too much time to fashion. I'm sorry. Each of these spikes would need to be individually sharpened."
Mariko nodded, trying to tamp down her disappointment. Having a weapon of this sort would have been an advantage to her for many reasons, most of which she meant to conceal in the darkest recesses of her mind. For now. Before she could succumb to disappointment, she shored up her resolve. Recalled this thought, "True weakness is weakness of the spirit." She refused to give up so easily.
"What if we could make a mold instead? Perhaps even reduce the number of blades?"
Mariko used her stick to smooth the ground over her previous rendering and fashion another. "The mold could first be cast in beeswax, similar to an arrowhead. That way it could be sharpened with relative ease." Haruki stood, walked around the newest drawing, his head canted in consideration. Quite suddenly, the metalsmith stopped pacing.
"Come with me,"
he said, his tone crisp. Haruki proceeded to march down the hill, his long legs carrying him fast. Mariko ran to keep up as he strode toward another tent across the way, a larger tent, with a guard posted at its entrance. The tent to which Mariko had been trying to gain access ever since she was first brought to the Black Clan's encampment against her will. The tent of Takeda Ranmaru. Outside the entrance, several younger members of the Black Clan watched two weathered veterans play a game of Go. All appeared to be betting on the outcome, copper and silver links dotting a worn tatami mat. Several smaller coins had been thrown to the wayside, almost slipping out of notice. Mariko slid one beneath her sandaled foot, to surreptitiously pocket it later. There could be a time I might need money. Before Mariko had a chance to collect the coin, Haruki paused near the entrance, waiting for her. With what Mariko hoped was an innocent smile, she moved forward, quickly dragging the copper coin beneath her straw sandal. Haruki began speaking to Ranmaru, even before Mariko came to a stop beside him. Despite what she'd initially thought, the metalsmith was not one to linger without purpose. His idea isn't a bad one. The weapon itself would be small, light, much easier to aim than a traditional kunai. But the time and cost it would take to make it almost negates its value. Of course, the leader of the Black Clan did not look surprised to see them, nor did he appear surprised to learn of Haruki's conclusion. As Mariko had suspected, Yoshi had told Ranmaru about her invention. Mariko opened her mouth to speak, and was unceremoniously pushed forward by the tent's newest arrival, an arrival whose scent made his presence known even before he came into view. Warm stone and wood smoke. By the grace of the old gods, Mariko managed to remain mostly in place when Okami rammed an elbow into her side, clearing the path before him. "I sincerely apologize," she said to Okami, trying her best to keep her store of sarcasm in reserve. "I guess it must be quite difficult to see that which is directly in front of you." Well, she did try. "No." Okami's face wore a silent challenge, his eyes glinting as he glanced back at her. "I saw you." For an instant, Mariko thought she also caught a trace of amusement as he brushed by. "And even if I hadn't seen you, I definitely smelled you. When was the last time you bathed?" That same awful feeling of being mocked took hold of Mariko. Vicious, unrelenting hold, making her feel so much smaller than those around her. So much less of everything when all she wished to feel was taller and stronger and braver. So much more, it made her afraid to be herself. Afraid these men would see how every step she took each day was a lie. "Enough. This is not the time to be weak." Instead of letting the fear allow her to shrink into herself, Mariko let it feed her. It collected in her stomach, twisting in her throat, reshaping into anger. No, she did not have time to be angry with Okami. Being angry with him meant she cared, and she absolutely did not care. It was far easier not to care. Mariko pursed her lips, glowering at the leanly muscled back before her. When Okami realized she'd kept silent at his provocation, he peered at her over one shoulder. The confusion that passed across his face almost made Mariko's efforts worth the trouble. Absent-mindedly ruffling his hair, the wolf glided toward a corner of the tent, settling on a pile of silk cushions. Then he closed his eyes, as though he meant to rest. "How was Hanami?" Ranmaru asked Okami, disregarding his friend's obvious desire to sleep. At her right, Mariko heard Haruki sigh to himself. Okami ignored the metalsmith's quiet judgment. "As one would expect..." With a yawn, he burrowed into the cushions. Hanami? Of course this lazy boy with little regard for honor frequented the most infamous pleasure district in Inako. That, at least, offered Mariko an answer as to where he'd been disappearing every other day. Hot on the heels of this newest realization came a different series of questions. Inako was several hours' ride from the forest. "You went to Inako?" Mariko asked automatically. Why would you journey so far simply to go to Hanami? Are there not pleasure houses nearby?
Pleasure houses? He scoffed. It's clear Lord Lackbeard does not have the first clue about the joys Hanami has to offer.
Though his eyes remained closed, one side of Okami's lips curled upward. Ranmaru frowned in response. Mariko bristled.
Though I've never seen Hanami myself, I have every idea what happens in a liar.
She crossed her arms. Irritation snaked through her chest, yet Mariko made the decision to say nothing, as she'd found it to be the best response in situations like these. When she knew words would not serve her well.
Okami's dark eyes flashed open. Mariko had to admit it was an admirable feat.
How he was able to shift from casual apathy to absolute awareness in a single breath.
Interesting. He unfurled to standing. Glided toward her, once more the shark seeking blood in the water.
I called you a liar, yet you've said nothing to refute that.
Unusual, considering your regard for all things honorable.
The closer Okami moved toward her, the more Mariko's worry collected, the more she wished to retreat. Sometimes he saw her too clearly for comfort. Again, the irritation gathered in her stomach, nodding into anger.
I will not yield to my emotions.
Okami stared down at her, just as he had that night they'd first met. Mariko stood her ground, disregarding her desire to flee.
It's obvious you haven't the faintest clue what Hanami is, he said softly. You lie as freely as you breathe, yet claim to value honor above all else.
His laughter was a brush of air and sound.
What other secrets are you hiding beneath that cool head of yours, Sanada Takeo? And what would it take to steal them from you?
He whispered, his eyes shimmering like black ice.
Blood rushed up Mariko's neck, into her face. As before, she stoked her fear into fury, into a strange kind of heat that began to swirl in the space between them.
You don't know the beginning of me. She trembled as she spoke. And you will never see the end.
It was as close to a threat as she dared.
His smile was cool, appreciative.
I've made you angry.
Anger can be a good thing, Ranmaru interjected, his features unreadable. It can harden you, make you stronger.
Perhaps my kind of strength isn't the same as yours. Perhaps my kind of strength is as light as a feather.
As deadly as an idea. Her hands continued to shake beneath their gazes, yet she returned Okami's measured stare. The wolf nodded, but Mariko did not see mockery in the gesture. Merely the same strange intensity, as though he truly approved.
Master your anger, Sanada Takeo. Anger is an emotion that poisons all else.
I am not angry. It's possible you do not know me as well as you think you do.
Mariko willed him silent, determined not to argue with him any further. Arguing with Okami was like trying to catch smoke.
His only reply was another half-smile punctuated by a white scar. But his smile was not the playful sort. No. Despite his barbed attempt at banter, the wolf was not playful. Not at all. He was a boy who liked to set fire to things and watch them burn.
Mariko's anger quickly slid to animosity.
It irked her that Okami could provoke such strong emotions from her with so little effort. Ranmaru stepped between them, separating them, dissipating the heat that had risen in the air.
"I'll make you a deal, Lord Lackbeard," he said. "If you succeed in helping Haruki find a way to make this... what do you call it?"
The metalsmith moved to reply, his lips already forming the words.
"A throwing star," Mariko said before Haruki could speak, her words clipped.
Her attention lingered on Okami as he returned to his cushioned corner, his hands now laced beneath his head. At this moment, it did not behoove Mariko to look away from him. As he'd once warned, she should never bare her neck to a wolf.
Ranmaru continued,
his manner contemplative. Successfully fashion a throwing star, and the next time Okami travels to Hanami, we will accompany him. At this, the wolf stood again, unfailingly graceful despite a glimmer of annoyance. A snake-like smile spread across Ren's face, just as Ranmaru broke into a pleased grin. It was clear this newly formed proposal appealed to the leader of the Black Clan, perhaps simply because he was antagonizing his best friend, a feat Mariko guessed to be rather difficult. In answer, Okami stepped closer, his jaw tight. A tacit threat. For her benefit or for that of Ranmaru, Mariko could not be certain. Nor did she care. For it pleased her, too, to rankle the wolf. Ranmaru's grin widened. While in Hanami, we can... How did you say it that night, Lord Lackbeard? Teach you how to enjoy such things? At the flagrance of his words, the blood began to drain down Mariko's neck. I don't think that's necessary. Her eyes flitted around the tent, her skin now cast a sickly pallor. As I said before, I am fully aware of what happens in Hanami, and when you're about to lie, don't look to the skies first, Okami said. The old gods won't help you. In the future, I'll be sure to heed your advice, she retorted quickly, curtly, her gaze locked on the scar slicing through his lips. But I was busy making a promise to remedy their past mistake. His brows raised in question. This time I promise to cut out your tongue instead of simply leaving a warning. Mariko almost gasped as the words fell from her mouth. These were the words of a different person. Wild, dangerous, without fear. Perhaps Sanada Takeo had far more nerve than Hattori Mariko. Perhaps Takeo didn't mind risking punishment if it meant earning respect. Though the beat of Mariko's heart raced through her veins, she kept her expression fixed, unmoved. The wolf's eyes narrowed. The muscles along his jaw twitched. Whether it was from anger or amusement, Mariko dared not guess. A spell of tense silence passed. Then Ranmaru laughed. Loudly. A thoughtless, heedless kind of laughter, different from any she'd heard pass his lips before. Even Haruki and Ren seemed startled by its sound. When Mariko's tormentor made to shove her as punishment for her insult, she shifted beyond his reach. Ren pressed forward, intent on teaching her a lesson. His persistence forced Mariko to step in the space occupied by either Ranmaru or Okami. Without thought, she shifted to the left. Beside her sandaled foot, a copper coin winked into view. A harrowing beat passed before Okami bent to retrieve it. He did not move away as he aimed a bladed smile at her. Mariko bumped against him, suppressing a cringe. He returned the coin to her, all while standing close enough that she smelled the wood smoke on his clothes, felt the warmth radiating from his skin. A low hum began to form around him. Immediately, Mariko swallowed the urge to cower, grateful for the shadows that concealed the color in her cheeks. Was it from anger, then? Did anger unleash Okami's abilities? Was he angry with her? Or amused? Why was it so hard for her to read this accursed boy? So now you've become a thief as well, he said softly, his dark gaze filled with an uncanny light. Fashion your throwing star. Take your winnings to Inako. But don't feel fortunate when you do. The streets of the Imperial City are only slightly less forgiving than I. The leader of the Black Clan waited until Ren, Haruki, and Sanada Takeo were far beyond earshot. He glanced at his best friend, his closest confidant since the darkest of times. What do you think of our newest recruit? Ranmaru asked. Okami scowled in the direction of the tent entrance before replying. He's quite smart, and equally odd. Oddly smart, then. Two qualities that engender concern. I don't trust him. What's to trust? Ranmaru tossed a silk cushion onto the packed earth, then took position over the ledgers strewn across the scarred low table. Anyway, it's unlike you to care about such a thing.
Okami remained standing. We should leave him in Anako. He won't last a day in its bowels.
Or perhaps we should simply let the forest have him. Ranmaru shrugged.
Perhaps.
The wolf did not sound convinced. Ranmaru stopped skimming through the ledger.
Do you suspect he knows anything?
No. But he makes me feel uncomfortable. I'm not certain why you wanted to bring him here. Why you thought he would make a good addition to our ranks.
Ranmaru paused. They were both aware that very little made the wolf uncomfortable. Okami had spent his formative years impressing a sense of discomfort onto others, impressing it and taking advantage of the aftermath. It was far easier to bend the will of those amid strife.
Sanada Takeo is different from anyone else in the Black Clan, Ranmaru said. He's lost in a way that intrigues me, intelligent in a way that could make him quite useful to our cause.
He paused again.
What about him makes you feel uncomfortable?
It's odd for anyone this insignificant to bother you so.
The beginnings of a smile began to cross his lips.
Or for anyone to remain unchecked after repeatedly challenging you.
Okami said nothing for a time. Does the boy not make you uncomfortable?
He finally asked, his voice inexplicably hesitant.
Does he not make you ask yourself strange questions?
No, Ranmaru replied. Not any more than usual.
I'll agree he's strange. But have you seen Ren? Ren is a boy lost between two worlds. That tends to happen when you witness your parents being butchered before your eyes,
Okami said.
Of course Ren would be strange.
Well, it's possible Sanada Takeo has seen such things as well.
Possible, but unlikely.
He's far too green to have witnessed anything truly horrific. Did you see how long it took him to put together a simple tent?
I thought you left that tent to test him.
That's immaterial. For someone as smart as he, Sanada Takeo should have realized he was missing pieces long before Yoshi brought it to his attention. It's obvious the boy has never had to fend for himself in his life. He's coddled in a worrisome way. Likely the son of a wealthy man, book-learned and world-foolish.
Ranmaru sighed. I leave it to you, then. Whatever decision you make as to whether the boy stays or goes, I support you.
His left brow arched high into his forehead.
But he's your responsibility in Inako. You earned that privilege by antagonizing him as you did today. And if I were you, I would be far more vigilant about how much you allow Sanada Takeo under your skin.
Okami turned at this, clearly intent on disavowing the notion, but Ranmaru raised a hand, cutting him off before he could speak.
Take Takeo to the tea house as promised. Then do what you will with him afterward.
Ranmaru flattened a blank sheet of washi paper and began rubbing a dampened ink stick into the ink well beside him.
Though I'm inclined to let Takeo stay, as he might prove to be quite an asset.
Oddly smart ideas notwithstanding.
Okami did not respond immediately.
We shall see.
Rivets of gold and petal-pink waters.
Inako. A city of 100 arched bridges and 1,000 cherry trees. A city of mud and sweat and sewage. A city of golden cranes and amber sunsets. A city of secrets. The Imperial City had changed in the 4 years since Kenshin had last been within its walls. It was clearly bigger. The outskirts of Inako now pressed beyond the fields and forests that had ringed its borders in the past. Snaking through the city's center was a gently flowing river, littered with dying blossoms. Its petal-pink waters were a painted stroke, separating the tiled roofs on either shoreline, a swell of blue-gray clay rising like the sea, bandied about by a storm. Kenshin's mother had once said the entire story of the Imperial City could be told by its roof tiles alone.
The curved clay marked where the grandest sections of Inako gave way to its poorer thoroughfares, its downtrodden lanes. Where the rounded tiles and the gleaming angles dipped into dusty disrepair, where they vanished into the parts of the city Kenshin had never frequented. The number of cracked and misshapen rooflines had become even more staggered and crowded in the last 4 years. Strange how, regardless of wealth or circumstance, they all appeared to use the same kind of tile. The same color, the same shape. A strange marriage of chaos and conformity. In that same way, Inako looked smaller to him now, despite its obvious growth. Kenshin mulled over this as he rode with his men past the main gates of the city. Vendors lingered on either side of a long dirt lane, selling neatly stacked fruit and freshly washed produce. Several children hawked small hemp sacks of crisp rice crackers, their faces and hands clean despite the ragged appearance of their clothes. A stall displaying perfect rounds of sweet daifuku caught Kenshin's eye as he passed by. He smiled as he remembered how much Mariko had loved to eat the fluffy rice cakes filled with sweetened bean paste. How they'd always fought over the last of the daifuku whenever their father had brought home a box from Inako. As children, Kenshin and Mariko had squabbled quite often, their fights becoming the stuff of legend. As epic as the wars depicted in their history lessons, replete with subterfuge and elegant misdirection. Kenshin had always tried to best her physically, while Mariko had always fought to unseat him mentally. His sister had won more times than Kenshin had cared to admit. He smiled to himself as a shower of memories descended on him. Mariko was not dead. She was simply fighting a different kind of war. Though Kenshin had yet to understand her purpose, he believed in his younger sister, supported her, just as he knew she believed in and supported him. They would always be there for each other, whatever may come. Kenshin's small convoy paused as Imperial guards inspected the endless line of wagons and weary travelers entering Inako. As soon as the Hattori crest was seen, he and his men were waved past the line. Kenshin had elected to take only 15 of his best soldiers with him to the Imperial City. 5 samurai and 10 ashigaru. Before he'd left his family's domain at dawn, Kenshin had realized a larger contingent of men would draw more whispers, elicit further speculation. He did not want anyone to suspect the truth behind why he'd journeyed to Inako. Though it was unlikely, there was still a small chance not everyone at court knew about the events that had befallen his sister in Jukai Forest. When he'd returned home, several of his father's advisers had informed him it was possible the Black Clan was to blame for plundering Mariko's convoy and setting fire to her norimono. The notorious band of thieves was known to haunt that section of the woods. Initially, Kenshin had thought to seek them out, to feather his soldiers throughout the hills and hunt them down. But doing so without hesitation almost felt too easy. The Black Clan did not usually attack convoys containing women and children. Assigning them immediate blame felt prearranged, as though someone intended all along for Kenshin to split his forces and lose his footing in a relatively short time. The suggestion reeked of the same elegant misdirection he had grown accustomed to while warring with his sister. Except that now, the battle was not over a sweet treat, but over lives. If Kenshin could be certain of anything, he could be certain of this. Such machinations had been and always would be the purview of those in power. First he wanted to hear what the nobles in the Imperial City had to say. He hoped the story of the Black Clan had not spread too far. Hoped it remained within the inner circles of Inako and stayed that way for however long it could. At least, until Kenshin was able to recover Mariko safe and sound, and before word of their family's misfortune spread throughout the empire and ruined the Hattori name beyond repair. Apprehension gripped Genshin as he rode through the winding streets of the Imperial City, his back straight and his features impenetrable. Behind him, mounted samurai and foot soldiers bearing banners emblazoned with the Hattori crest trailed in neat formation. The scent of fresh water and swirling dust suffused the air as their convoy neared the deep moat enclosing Heian Castle. Kenshin left his 10 Ashigaru and 3 of his samurai in a clean set of barracks just beyond the curved stone wall at the edge of the moat. Then he and his 2 remaining samurai crossed the wooden drawbridge, pausing before the first set of towering black gates at the castle's entrance. Gold-plated hinges and round-ringed handles glistened in the late afternoon sun, as Kenshin and his men waited to speak with the Imperial troops manning the guard tower. When 2 of the soldiers stepped forward to address Kenshin formally, he noticed the silk banners flying on either side of the glossy black gates. Even the rivets were plated in gold. No expense had been spared to make Heian Castle a worthy seat for the Empire's heavenly sovereign. The Imperial Guard stood rigid, inspecting all the weaponry Kenshin and his men wished to bear with them. As samurai, Kenshin and his men were allowed to enter the castle bearing 2 customary swords each, a katana and a shorter wakizashi. Hidden weapons were considered dishonorable, as was the act of unsheathing a blade in the Emperor's presence. Just before the second pair of gates, Kenshin and his samurai were instructed to leave their horses with one of the stable attendants waiting nearby. Then they began to ascend the immense stone staircase leading to the Imperial grounds. The weight of his armor and the heat of the early summer sun slowed Kenshin's pace, but it also offered him a chance to take in the splendor of the Imperial castle rising before him, each of its 7 gabled stories and gilded rooftops flashing, catching, throwing endless rays of light. When the first of 8 concentric baileys rose into view, Kenshin paused. This series of maru was famous even beyond the reaches of the Empire. Its inner workings were said to be enchanted, crafted by an ageless kind of sorcery. The first and largest maru was complete with a pond and maze-like pathways graveled by white stone. The pattern of its spiraling walkways served 2 purposes, one of beauty and one of befuddlement. It was designed to confound, for the entrances and exits did not flow in logical order. At all hours of day and night, the concentric circles moved in different directions, at different speeds, like wheels turning within each other. Absent a knowledgeable escort, a guest could get lost at Heian Castle without even trying, and an intruder would never make it out alive. Kenshin halted before taking the final step onto the trimmed grass of the first maru. This marked the only occasion he had ever been to Inaka without his father, without his family. Today would be the first day he and he alone would represent his clan before their emperor. Kenshin had not expected to feel so uneasy at this realization, but he did not show it, would never show it. Instead, he took the last step, careful to remain steady, to enjoy these brief moments to himself, while he still could. Contrary to what Kenshin had expected, he was not instructed to go before the Emperor upon his arrival, a fact that gave him pause. Instead, Kenshin and his men were told to wait for a time on the enchanted maru. They crossed the perfectly manicured lawn, stopping only to watch the 100-year-old carp and its gaggle of orange and white koi flit beneath the waters of an azure pond. One of the Emperor's attendants then bowed low before Kenshin, calmly leading him toward another maru, past another series of inner gates. As they moved through the arched entrance, Kenshin felt the ground beneath him shift, felt it turn slowly to conceal their trail and keep him and his men from view. They quickly exited the second bailey and flew down a staircase leading to a grassy field ringed by a gathering of richly garbed onlookers. Soon, Kenshin understood why he and his men had been brought here, instead of being formally received by the Emperor. They'd arrived at Heian Castle at a moment of spectacle. Beneath an eight-sided silk canopy, resting atop a tiered dais, sat Emperor Minamoto Masaru, upon his black lacquered throne. The balustrades on either side of him were painted vermilion. Eight silver phoenixes were mounted at every post. Hanging between these posts were flashing mirrors and curtains of spun silk, stamped in their centers with the imperial crest of the Minamoto clan. Strange that the emperor had chosen to display the phoenix alongside his own crest. The Minamoto crest was one of gentian flowers and bamboo leaves, a crest that signified prosperity and granted its bearer protection against evil. The phoenix crest had always been associated with the Takeda clan, a long line of shogun that had fallen from grace under a cloud of shame. When the last of the Takeda line had disappeared 10 years ago, the thousand-year joint reign between emperor and shogun, an emperor to rule the people, a shogun to lead the army, had disintegrated, had faded into remembrance. A part of Kenshin understood why the son of Takeda Shingen was unwilling to come forward, even following a decade of exile. His clan had collapsed in disgrace. His father had been compelled to end his life after conspiring to commit treason against the emperor. The emperor had been generous indeed to offer a traitor the honor of a warrior's death. A chance to die so that his son might live. No one knew for certain where this disgraced boy, this Ronin, might be. If he was still alive, he would be around Kenshin's age, perhaps a year or so older. In time, rumors had spilled from the lips of drunken soldiers, had rippled through lantern-lit gardens and spread like wildfire behind fluttering fans. The son of Takeda Shingen had become a beggar, a thief, a pirate, a whoremonger. He and his lost family had become the stuff of legend, a warning to all those who dared consider speaking out against the emperor. No matter how high a man rose in life, death was the greatest of equalizers. As a result of Takeda Shingen's treachery, both the might of the army and the will of the people now rested with the emperor. Perhaps that was why Minamoto Masaru had thought to marry the two symbols under his own banner. A phoenix flying alongside a crest of gentian flowers. A bird risen from the ashes of a bloody history. The thunder of stampeding hooves tore Kenshin from his thoughts. Cheers erupted from the throng of onlookers seated on plush cushions, their servants balancing colorful silk umbrellas above elaborate headdresses. The nobleman sat nearest to the emperor. The empress and her female attendants were gathered on a lower dais positioned to the right. On the grassy field before them, the Yabusame, the Imperial Army's elite force of mounted archers, conducted an exhibition. Most of the Imperial Court had come to partake in the scene. Kenshin had heard from others who frequented Inako that the Emperor often invited those in the nobility and their guests to witness the might of the Empire's army. The skill of its best soldiers and finest samurai. Though Kenshin was mildly interested in watching the display, he kept beyond the gathering of noblemen in their silken finery and the ladies of the court, fluttering their folded fans, kept apart and removed, as he often felt in such company. Kenshin had never been at ease around those in the imperial court. It was not that he harbored any judgment against them. He knew these shows of extravagance were necessary. They offered outsiders a glimpse of the empire's glory, and they gave its citizens a chance to revel in its greatness. As he continued watching the exhibition, Kenshin's expression began to sour. These were skilled riders, skilled archers, the best the empire had to offer. But it was still a show. And such immodesty did not sit well with the ideals of Bushido. Was not in keeping with the way of the warrior. Weapons were not meant for show. They were meant for war. Meant to be used in defense of a samurai's lord. In defense of one's family. And above all, in defense of the emperor. A member of the Yabusame soon drew every onlooker's notice. The young rider sat atop a dappled steed. One side of his fine silk robe hung from his right shoulder, revealing the armored silver yoroi hitatari beneath, freeing his arm for unencumbered movement. With a rattan-reinforced bow, he fired whistling arrows at a notched post 3 times in rapid succession, all while riding faster and more fearlessly than any of his peers. Not once did the young warrior reach for the reins, but directed his horse entirely with his knees. Even from a distance, Kenshin could see how he rode. Heels down, locked in place, steady. Excellent horsemanship was a requisite of being in the Yabusame, as was the ability to fire arrows at high speeds with uncanny accuracy. Not once did the warrior miss his target. Whispers of admiration rippled through the crowd. They unfurled into a steady murmur when a slight boy clad in silks stained a rare shade of yellow, almost like burnished gold, took position at the opposite end of the field. Kenshin did not immediately recognize him, but he felt certain the boy had to be the crown prince, Minamoto Roku. Though he'd never met him before, Kenshin had heard from both his father and from Nobutada that the crown prince did not possess a striking appearance, yet nevertheless managed to hold his own at court. Kenshin could see why now. There was a noble bearing to the boy, a distinct haughtiness to the set of his thin shoulders and the tilt of his pointed chin. The only member of court with finer robes was the emperor himself. The crown prince drove 3 kaburaya into the ground. Kenshin immediately noticed how the whistling arrowheads did not appear to be the blunted sort generally used for practice. Without pausing for thought, the crown prince fitted one of these arrows to the string of his bow. At that exact moment, the finest archer of the Yabusame, the one who had caught everyone's attention earlier, broke ranks and began riding toward the crown prince, with no sign of stopping. Concern flared through Kenshin. Several members of the nobility took to their feet, alarm spreading across their faces. Without even a glimmer of concern, the crown prince fired an arrow at the warrior on the gray and white steed. The warrior dodged it, effortlessly sliding from his saddle, as the horse continued its wild gallop. He clutched the reins as his feet sluiced through the soft earth. When the crown prince fired another shot, the warrior vaulted back onto his saddle, easily avoiding the arrow's mark. He continued riding toward the crown prince, undeterred. The crown prince's shots were well-timed, well-aimed, meant to strike. But the rider drew closer and closer to the crown prince, refusing to veer, refusing to yield. At the last possible second, the crown prince fired another arrow straight at the warrior's chest. The warrior yanked it from the air, and quicker than a flash of lightning, knocked it to his bow. He fired it back at the crown prince. The arrow embedded in the dirt at a perfect angle, a hair's breadth from the prince's feet. The crown prince smiled. As soon as the warrior reined in near him, he dismounted and removed his helmet. Then he bowed low. Grinning at one another, the 2 young men clapped each other on the back appreciatively. The smattering of awkward applause became cheers. Only members of the royal family would be permitted to touch the crown prince with such impunity. Kenshin saw the resemblance. Despite the fact that the member of the Yabusame was nearly a head taller, considerably broader. The rider was Prince Raiden, his sister's betrothed. "I was very sorry to hear about your sister's untimely death, Kenshin-sama," Minamoto Roku said as he dropped to his cushioned seat before a low table in the corner of his chambers. Though the crown prince's words sounded heartfelt, Kenshin did not feel any warmth in them. The statement was coolly pronounced,
said with the same inflection Roku might have offered when commenting on a spate of bad weather. The contrivance in the prince's tone bothered Kenshin, but he stifled his irritation. After all, he was in the presence of royalty, at audience with the emperor's two sons. Mariko's betrothed, and the future heavenly sovereign of Wa.